have a seat. Good morning.
Wow, good group. Holy cow.
This morning, Justice Kroski is appearing by phone. If she were here, she would see that we have students almost all the way up to the bench today, Justice Kroski, so it's quite something. We have the School District of Loyal here. If you could rise, please. Wow. Okay, then. You are here. And go ahead and have a seat. The Friendship Circle Teen Leadership from Fox Point. Wow, another great group. We have had great groups today. Go ahead and have a seat. It's really nice to have you here. Interns from Governor Evers' office. Another great group. This is just fabulous. It's wonderful having you here today. Welcome to the Wisconsin Supreme Court, all of you. Go ahead and have a seat. We are now hearing our second case of the day, 21 AP 373, Derek Sanders versus State of Wisconsin Claims Board, 21 AP 373. Appearances, please.
Assistant Attorney General Colin Roth on behalf of the Claims Board. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court.
Good morning. One second.
Oh.
Counsel, your appearance. All right. Good morning. The lineup I have is 25 minutes followed by 35 minutes on rebuttal, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Very good. Please proceed.
May it please the Court. More than a century ago, Wisconsin became the first state to enact a statute empowering the state board to provide no-fault compensation to wrongfully imprisoned people. This was a boon to those wrongfully imprisoned. It allowed them to recover money without pursuing lengthy, uncertain civil litigation against the state and their defense attorneys. But the legislature, mindful of the budgetary impact of such payments, capped the amount the board could award. The legislature also recognized that it might sometimes be appropriate to award more than the statutory cap, and so it reserved that power to itself. Under the statutory scheme, when the board believes that extra compensation would be appropriate, it must submit a recommendation to the legislature, which alone has the unilateral authority to pass or reject a private bill awarding more than the statutory cap. So, when considering extra compensation, the board's role is akin to that of a legislative aide giving advice to the legislature, not an agency acting in a quasi-judicial manner, resolving legal rights subject to judicial review. Here, the petitioner, Sanders, is upset that the board awarded him the statutory maximum but declined to recommend that the legislature pay him more. Now, regardless of one's view on whether Sanders might have been deserving of more compensation than he received, the only question here is one of statutory interpretation.
Counsel, in that regard, and I liked that you started with the 1913 bill, turn back with me to those thrilling days of 1913. And you say on page 33 of your brief, essentially, after citing that law, that you say the 1913 law thus required the board, not yet the claims board, to find the amount which will compensate the petitioner. And then you write full stop. So is it your position that if the 1913 act was still in effect, that your argument would be different than it is here today?
No, Your Honor, for two reasons. I believe, first, this issue of determining total compensation is, I call it a bit of a red herring here, I think, and the reason for that is what the record shows, I think, is that the claims board did, in fact, in this case, determine what the total appropriate compensation should have been for Mr. Sanders.
Let me push you a little bit, because it perhaps gives more context to my question if I read the next sentence or two. And that is, after your comment on page 33, full stop, you seem to be suggesting that, in contrast, the language was revised in 1935 to remove the full funding requirement. Let me be specific. After your full stop, you say the legislature, however, revised that language in 1935 to remove the full funding requirement and instead limited the board's finding to the statutory maximum. I read that, and tell me why I'm reading it wrong, I read that as you saying if the 1913 were still in effect, there wouldn't be such a limitation, full stop. But the legislature revised the language and in 1935 to remove what was the full funding requirement and instead limited it. So what am I reading wrong when I'm reading what you wrote on page 33?
So I think that accurately characterizes one part of our argument, and that is that there was a meaningful amendment to this statute in 1935. Now, I know there's the whole issue of it being passed through a revisor's bill. What does that mean? And we can talk more about that. But I do think if you just look at the plain language and compare the plain language of those two statutes, the structure did change in a material way. In the original version of the bill, there was a standalone sentence that in part read, the board shall find the amount for which the amount which will compensate the petitioner, period. And it had no limitations on the board's discretion or authority to find that amount. Now, I think that meaningfully changed to the amendment when, in its current form, which I think is essentially equivalent to when it was amended in the 30s, added on a limiting clause to that sentence, which said not to exceed $25,000. Now, I think if we look at the plain language of the statute, that does impose, that's meaningfully different. Before, there was no cap. Now there is a cap. But I will return to my earlier comment in response to Your Honor's question, which is I don't think that really matters in this case because I do believe the record shows that what the claims board did here was effectively make a decision that $25,000 was the appropriate amount. And what this case is really about is whether it had to explain that decision not to recommend more to the legislature in writing. That's really what's going on here. What if anything more did the claims board need to say?
Let me clarify again then. Is it your position that if the 1913 Act was still in effect, that
we would still win this
case? You would have full funding. Let me do it this way. That the 1935 revision removed the full funding requirement. Is that your position? Well, that's what you said.
Sure, Your Honor. I think if by remove the full funding requirement, you mean it now imposed a cap on what the board can consider to be equitable compensation, I think that's absolutely correct. But my basic point is, I don't think it really matters at the end of the day because I do believe the record shows that the board did make that decision here. It didn't explain it in great detail in writing, but I think that's the whole point of this case. That's what we're here to decide. What more did it need to say, if anything? And so I'd like to return to a point I was making at the start, which is the different function that the board is that the board is exercising when it does different parts of its duties under this statute. And so I'll just briefly talk about the three steps that happen here under Chapter 775.05 and what the board is doing at each of those stages. So there, I think, are two stages at the start, one of which is determining innocence. Did this petitioner show that they are innocent of the crime for which they were imprisoned? And then second, if so, what amount of equitable compensation between $0 and $25,000 is appropriate? Now, I think when the board is resolving those questions, what it's doing is acting in a quasi-judicial capacity. It's reviewing legal rights the petitioners may have to compensation and resolving those rights. But the third step, which is what we're here talking about today, which is recommendations to the legislature to appropriate more money, those are very different kinds of decisions than the ones that are made at steps one and two. Rather than resolving legal rights that petitioners have to an innocence determination and equitable compensation, What the board is effectively doing is acting again as an advisor to the legislature. Should the legislature enact a bill paying this person more than the $25,000 statutory cap? And so when we think about that function, this advisory function to the legislature, that's naturally not one that's subject to judicial review. It's almost as if Sanders himself had gone directly to the legislature, which he certainly can do, and lobbied the legislature to enact a bill paying him more than what he could get from the board. The legislature, for whatever reason, may dismiss his request, it may not explain it, but of course that's not a reviewable decision. There are no legal standards, no legal rights as to what the legislature would have to do in response to Mr. Sanders' requests. So too here. I think this is exactly the same situation as that one. The board is effectively acting as an adjunct to the legislature, as an advisor to the legislature when considering the requests for more money. And so when the board makes decisions, there's naturally not going to be judicial review of whether it gives this kind of advice to the legislature or that kind of advice. And so given that there's no judicial review of that decision, there's naturally no need for a written explanation because, again, the whole point of written explanations, of course, when agencies render judicial, quasi-judicial types of decisions is precisely so they can be reviewed by a circuit court, appellate court, et cetera, et cetera.
Along those lines, and this question is from Justice Krofsky, there is a 227 review. So how would anyone ever be able to challenge this decision when there's no record of what they did and didn't consider when reaching that amount?
Right. My answer to that is, if you look at 227, I don't believe that the kind of decision about whether to advise the legislature one way or the other actually is subject to review under Chapter 227, and I'll explain why.
Well, let me ask you this along those lines, and then you can explain why. It's not a decision whether to recommend it to the legislature, and I'm going to go back to the 1913 statute since you think that you would win under this, too. It says if the board shall find that the amount they may be able to award will not be adequate compensation, then it talks about the legislature. So the finding is with respect to the amount of the award and whether it's adequate or not. What you do next is going to the legislature. So why wouldn't you have to have some meaningful ability to review that finding? Why wouldn't a petitioner have that?
Because, again, I think there's no legal right at issue to more than $25,000. That's the bottom line here. At the first two steps of the process, the petitioner may have a right to money from the state, not a discretionary award from the legislature, but I am entitled to equitable compensation for the time I served in prison while I was innocent. That is a right that's created by 775.05, and when the board resolves those rights, it is rendering decisions that are subject to judicial review under 227. And I think if we look at 227, and specifically 227.52, that, of course, is our judicial review statute for administrative decisions, and it defines the kinds of decisions that are subject to judicial review. And those are, quote, decisions that, now I'm quoting, adversely affect ... substantial interests. Those are the kinds of decisions that are subject to judicial review. And so the question is, well, what is a substantial interest, right? So we can look, for instance, to Friends of Black River Falls, the recent decision from this court that talks about a substantial interest that entitles one to judicial review as one that is protected, recognized, or regulated by law. Those are the kinds of interests when an agency resolves them to which someone's entitled to judicial review. And I don't think that's what we have here at the third step of the question, precisely because the petitioner never has a right to more money. The only thing the petitioner may get is, again, advice from the board, a recommendation from the board, but not any sort of mandate that the legislature appropriate more money.
Right, so isn't it being regulated? First of all, I want to go back, actually, to how you started this out with a boon. That he's somehow getting a boon or that they got a boon. These are people who've been wrongfully imprisoned by our state. How many years was he wrongfully imprisoned?
I believe it was 26 years, Your Honor.
26 years of his life. So you want to tell me that that's not a recognized right to some kind of compensation
and that it's not being regulated by the statute? I mean, I get that the remedies, like, I feel like you're tying it into what they then have to do. And they have to go to the legislature because that's who the purse strings are, right? That's where the money comes from. Mm-hmm. But what about that? What about the regulation coming from the statute? What about the fact that this is someone's liberty that was taken away by the state of Wisconsin, wrongfully?
Right. I agree. I mean, that is the purpose of this statute. An injustice was done, someone was wrongfully imprisoned, and so the legislature recognized, again, first of its kind in the nation, that prisoners should be paid for that. And this is a new right. Again, there are civil rights claims that one might have, there are malpractice claims that one might have, but this kind of claim is a new right that the legislature created, a new legal right. So I think to understand the scope of that legal right, we have to look at the statute as it is today and examine, well, what exactly, like, what is the nature of that legal right? What exactly does a petitioner potentially have the right to receive? And I know I'll sound a bit like a broken record, but again, the legislature is very clear that the only rights that a petitioner may have is to receive money up to $25,000. Now, should that limit be increased? Obviously, there are differences of opinion. Some believe that it should, some believe that it shouldn't. But again, this question is a different one. I mean, this is, what can a petitioner come to the board and say, I have a right to this money? I look at the statute to see what that right entails. It's $25,000. And potentially, if the board thinks that's not enough, as some people might when thinking about his years of imprisonment, the board may write a recommendation, but again, it's advice. This is as an aid to the legislature.
So doesn't this depend on how you define the right? I hear you defining the right as you have the right to what the limit is. But isn't the right the fact that the board is going to determine what will compensate him? That's the right. And yes, there's limits on the right, but the right isn't the limit. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, if you have a right to the consideration of the compensation, then in this case, there has to be some kind of finding about what he was deserving of.
See, I don't think so. I mean, but I'll step back, and if we look at the record, I do think he received that finding. He just didn't receive the explanation that he wants, an extra, you know, totting up of you know, factors on one side of the equation or the other that led the board to the decision it made. But it did expressly say $25,000 is what we think is enough. Now, he doesn't like that. I understand. He thinks he should get more. But the legislature entrusted a recommendation about more money solely to the claims board. And I think if you look at the criteria that it gave, it helps us think about, well, what would judicial review even look like of this decision? Assuming for the sake of argument that you could review, you know, this decision to recommend more or not. If you look at the text of the current statute, it talks about adequate compensation, and that's it. It says, if the claims board finds that the amount it is able to award is not an adequate compensation, she'll submit a report specifying an amount which it considers adequate. I think that language demonstrates both in the fact that it says it's an amount that the board itself considers adequate, and simply by using the word adequate with no further explanation. It's very difficult for me to imagine what a reviewing court would do with that.
How about look to see if they even met? What if you got, who knows? I mean, I don't want to cast any dispersion on what this board actually does or how often they meet, but what if they don't meet? What if they do it by email? What if they just meet and just say, okay, the legislature said $25,000, that's all we could give, when that's not the case, when they actually could give more? What if they don't understand that? Isn't that the purpose of judicial review?
Well, I don't think there's any indication that that's what happened in this case. I mean, what you see is a request from Mr. Sanders for well in excess of the $25,000 statutory maximum. I think he asked for over $5 million. And this issue came up at the hearing. There was a hearing on this request, and the claims board asked him, you know, what's this $5 million all about? And his answer was a combination of lost wages, you know, precedent, what the board has done in other situations. But it's clear that the board understood what he was asking for. It knew that he was asking for a recommendation for more money. And what you see is then it clearly understood that request. It addressed it at the hearing. The initial decision said, we find that $25,000 is equitable. There was no report that followed. Mr. Sanders then petitioned and said for a rehearing, and he said, well, you know, you didn't explain that, you know, why you didn't address my request for more money. And in response, the board said, well, we didn't find that $25,000 was inadequate, and so no further statutory duties were triggered, and, you know, you're done. So it did make that finding here. Now, again, I understand there may be disagreement. You know, people may have, you know, one person may think he was entitled to more, another person may have thought he was entitled to less, but that's not, again, that's not the question here. The question here is, on this third step, did the statute require them to explain that decision in writing in greater detail? And I don't see it in the text.
I have a question for you about the scope of review under Chapter 227. When I'm looking at the statute that we are interpreting in this case under Chapter 775, it has a couple of if-then statements, right? So the first if clause is if the petitioner, if the board finds the petitioner was innocent and did not contribute to bring about the conviction, then the claims board shall find the amount which will equitably compensate. So the obligations under the statute are to make findings. Neither party cited 227.57 sub 6, which says if the agency's action depends on any fact found by the agency in a contested case proceeding, which we have here, the court shall not substitute its judgment for that of the agency as to the weight of evidence on any disputed finding of fact. The court shall, however, set aside agency action or remand to the agency if it finds the agency's action depends on any finding of fact not supported by substantial evidence in the record. Does that subsection come into play in this case at all? If not, why not?
I don't think it does. Well, it doesn't with respect to the issue we're considering here with regard to extra compensation requests. And this, again, goes back to my earlier distinction I made about the function that the board is performing when it resolves, as you noted, the first two steps in this process, which is innocence and innocence determination and equitable compensation. When it's doing those two things, 227.52 and its substantial interest test tells us that those kinds of decisions are subject to review, and therefore the kind of review is we then look to 227.57 to see what the reviewing court would do with those decisions. But I don't even think we get that far with this step three decision here, which is, again, like I've said, essentially a legislative function. Another way that I think might be helpful to look at this situation is 227 does impose a default requirement on agencies when they render decisions that they issue findings of fact and conclusions of law. That's in 227.47 sub 1. Again, you got to write down the decisions that you make. However, I think what's important to note here is that 227.03 sub 5 expressly exempts the board from Chapter 227 procedures. So by default, Chapter 227 procedures do not apply to the claims board. Now, there is an exception for judicial review, and that's in 775.05 sub 5 itself, which says the board will be subject to judicial review for its findings and awards. But that does not include this written findings of fact and conclusions of law requirement in 227.47. So again, by default, the board is not required to write its decisions down, explain them, except to the extent that judicial review is available. So when judicial review is available, you got to write it down so the court can review and potentially reverse. But in this case, I don't think we even get to 227.57 sub 6, as Your Honor was asking about.
Well, if the petitioner had raised a claim in this case, and I don't think he did, that finding ostensibly made by the board that $25,000 would equitably compensate, then is it your argument that Chapter 227 review under sub 6 still doesn't apply? Because under sub 5 of 775, Mm-hmm. The findings shall be subject mm-hmm. to review under 227.
Right. So to be clear, I do agree that the award, the equitable compensation award that's capped at $25,000, the number the board chooses between 0 and 25, that is subject to judicial review. The statute says that very plainly. Subsection 5 says the award is subject to judicial review. So, you know, again, say the board was to award, say it only had awarded $15,000 in this case. Could have awarded $25,000, it has that authority. Only awarded $15,000. I do think that the petitioner could have sought review of that decision, said, look, the board could have given me $25,000. It didn't. I have a right to equitable compensation up to $25,000. I think that's what the number should have been. And, you know, the board got it wrong. I think that is a case that could happen, and the board would have to explain itself and defend that decision. But again, I think that only applies to these numbers between 0 and 25, because again, that's all the board can do. It can't do anything else than award that 25. It can write a report. It can advise the legislature that more might be adequate, appropriate in this case. But that's just not the kind of reviewable decision we typically think about when we think of agency action.
But it could have made a finding that even the maximum that it is authorized to award would not equitably compensate the petitioner, and that would be subject to judicial review, I think, under Chapter 227.
I don't think so. I do think had it made that finding, then it would have triggered the other duties that follow in Step 3, which is to write a report to the mm-hmm. legislature. So imagine, for instance, it did write that kind of decision. It said, we award Sanders $25,000, but we don't think that's adequate. But then it didn't go on to report that to the legislature as the rest of the statute requires. That's a situation in which you could imagine sort of a mandamus-type claim saying, look, you made that finding, but then you didn't do what the statute told you to do. I see my time is up, but I don't know if Justice Hagedorn wants to hop in with a question that he's been itching to ask. I can address it on rebuttal if that would be appropriate.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
May it please the court. Let me begin by telling the court what I hope to accomplish during my 30 minutes, but I don't have to tell you interruptions for questions are welcome. I would like to talk, number one, about what I perceive to be some inconsistency between the board's position here and the position taken in the board's briefs. I would like to walk the court chronologically through the text of the 1913 statute, the 1935 revisions through the lens of 990.001 sub 7, and then through the text of the statute today. I would like to answer Justice Rebecca Bradley's question earlier that my colleague here already had a chance to answer. And very briefly, time permitting, I would like to talk a little bit about the most minor issue, which is the role of the board's recommendation under Chapter 16.
Ultimately, what exactly is your ask of us? Is it that we change the award? Is it that we require the form of the decision to have more explicit factual findings? Is it something else? I'm not 100% clear what your ask is.
Let me start with what I'm not asking for. I am not asking. Well, some
afterwards?
Of yes, some of the suggestions I want to make clear. We are not asking for this court to change the award. And I'm going to answer Justice Rebecca Bradley's question because it's relevant to what you asked, and it's an important question. I would not characterize the determination that the board needs to make as a finding of fact. I understand the statute uses the word finding in Chapter 775. It does not refer to the amount of equitable compensation as a fact. I think that it is a discretionary determination, and we know that because the statute instructs the board to make a determination of equitable compensation, which requires discretion, not fact-finding. So what I'm asking the court to do is to remand this matter to the circuit court, but ultimately to the board, for it to exercise its discretion under a proper interpretation of 775.054, which, and we'll get to it, I do not believe that the board did the first time around.
Okay, so what did they need to say?
They do not need to, starting with the negative again, they do not need to use any particular form in what they say. The board needs to offer some explanation to explain the process of reasoning. And here I'm alluding to Reitinger, which is cited in our brief.
Okay, to explain the process of reasoning, why they didn't forward a recommendation to the legislature, or why 25 is enough, or what?
Why it chose the number it chose, whatever that number may be.
If they choose the maximum, statutory maximum, they still have to explain why that's adequate.
They do, whether it's the maximum or not. They need to offer some explanation. So there is a process of reasoning evidenced in the record that the circuit court and, if necessary, the appellate courts can review.
And so the word if, in your view, means what? That they always have to make that finding, if whether they award 10 or 5 or 15 or 25, they have to explain it.
Can I turn to the text of the statute to make sure I'm being clear?
Yes.
Termination, I think, happens in the first sentence of 775.054. And I'm going to talk about sentences, not steps, because I want to stick to the statutory text here. The claims board shall find the amount which will equitably compensate the petitioner, not to exceed $25,000 and at a rate of compensation not greater than $5,000 per year for the imprisonment. I think that the references to $25,000 and $5,000 are only reasonably construed as a limit on what the board may award. I think that if there is any doubt about that, looking at the first sentence of the statute, it is resolved by the last sentence of the statute, which says, and here's the if you were asking about, Chief Justice Ziegler, if the claims board finds that the amount it is able to award is not an adequate compensation.
Did they make that finding?
They did not make that finding.
Are they required to?
They are not required to find that the amount they are able to award is not an adequate compensation. But I do.
So when they didn't submit the report, does that mean anything, given the other findings and the conclusion of the maximum?
Well, here it means, based on the position that the board has taken in its briefs, that the board had an erroneous interpretation of law. And the board believed, according to, and I would direct the court to pages 37 through 38 and 40 of the board's opening brief, and then 5 through 6 and also 8 through 9 of the board's reply brief. The board believed, according to the board itself, that it did not have the power, when making the determination required under the first sentence of the statute, that it did not have the power to consider whether more than $25,000 was needed to equitably compensate Sanders. I think that it did, and that was a mistake of law. And before we even get to the 1913 and 1935 history, that last sentence of the current statute tells us that that view was mistaken, because there would be no point in the legislature telling the board in the last sentence what to do if it concludes that the amount it is able to award is not an adequate compensation, if the board were not required to determine, when conducting the inquiry under the first sentence, whether the amount it is awarding truly is the amount that will be needed to equitably compensate the petitioner. as opposed to being just the maximum amount that it has within its power to award without a recommendation to the legislature.
So their job is not to find whether or not they should get 5,000 the maximum amount a year. The first sentence alone, from what I'm hearing you argue, is that they are required to make a determination of the amount that will equitably compensate the petitioner. And then whatever that boundary is then set forth, but they have to make that finding.
That is correct. And the distinction between the finding of the amount that is needed to equitably compensate the petitioner and the amount that the board has the power to award, it was clearer in the 1913 statute where they were in two different sentences. And we can, time permitting, talk a little bit about the revisions later. But that is how I read the first sentence of the statute today. And I think the last sentence confirms it, because there would be no function to that last sentence if the board could not conclude, when it's making its determination of equitable compensation, that the amount it is empowered to award is not enough and does not rise to the level of compensation that it is determined is needed.
So your argument is the board didn't understand its ability to do what the last sentence says it can do.
I would phrase it a little bit differently. I would say the board did not understand what the first sentence directed it to do and what the last sentence confirms that it was empowered to do.
And where in the record does it indicate that the board didn't know that if it found the amount is not adequate, it could submit the report?
I would turn to page 40 of the opening brief submitted by the board, where the board took the position that it is neither equipped nor required to make a determination about the petitioner's total appropriate compensation. And on pages 37 and 38 as well of the, I think it was clear the board's position is that once it hit the $25,000 limit, it was done. It did not have discretion to determine that $26,000 or $27,000 was the amount that would equitably compensate Sanders.
I'd love to hear your statutory history arguments.
Thank you, Justice Hagedorn. The 1913 statute, which is quoted in full in our brief, if the justices do not have it in front of them, at page 24 of our opening brief, Section 4 in 1913, the first sentence concluded that if the innocence finding is made, the board shall proceed to find the amount which will compensate the petitioner for his wrongful imprisonment. And as the board said in its brief, full stop. At the time, there was then a distinct sentence that said, such board may award a compensation to the petitioner so found innocent of not to exceed $5,000 in any case, and at a rate of compensation not greater than $1,500 per year for the imprisonment so unjustly suffered. So in 1913, you have two completely different sentences. One refers to the finding of the amount needed to compensate the petitioner. The next sentence speaks of a limit on the power to award. And I want to draw that distinction between the finding of necessary compensation and the power to award. In 1935, those sentences were condensed. They were smooshed together into one. When we're looking at the 1935 revisions, there is another statute that comes into play. The legislature has told us that we need to look at those revisions through the lens of 990.001 sub 7. And both sentences in that statute are relevant. The first one says that a revised statute is to be understood in the same sense as the original, unless the change in language indicates a different meaning so clearly as to preclude judicial construction. The revisions to that went through in 1935, they are reprinted in our supplemental appendix. The relevant ones appear at page 5 of our appendix. Without reading them aloud, I think it is clear that what the reviser of statutes was simply condensing the language of the statute to make it more concise and compact.
You had mentioned, counsel, that you felt like your opposing counsel was potentially taking a little different position than in their briefs with regard to, I think it was with regard to these. And for what it's worth, that is the question that I was going to ask your counsel. I would love to hear in rebuttal, but I'd love to hear any comments that you are want to make on that.
Yes. So the standard again, and the standard is really critical. The question is, under 990.0017, do the revisions indicate a different meaning so clearly as to preclude judicial construction? And they do not. The legislature in 1935 left in the mandatory language stating that the board, at the time the commission, shall find the amount needed to equitably compensate the petitioner. The legislature would have gone much further if it had wanted to remove that power from the board, clearly deprive it of any discretion to determine that more than the maximum of its power to award was needed to equitably compensate the petitioner. And it also certainly, if the board had no discretion to determine that more was needed to equitably compensate the petitioner, it would not have left in the last sentence of the statute telling the board what to do if it concludes that more compensation is needed.
Do we have any evidence of how this statute was understood by the claims board historically, other than more recent history? I may or may not know, but I served on the claims board for about 5 years, and so had occasion to deal with these kinds of questions, in at least the way the board is representing its practice was consistent with my understanding. And so I'm curious whether you have any evidence of a contrary understanding at a different time.
And I've been alerted that if you could speak up, that would be helpful.
I will do so. Thank you. Yes, Justice Hagedorn, that's a good question. And I just this week also became aware that you served on the claims board. There is not I would not say that there's a great deal of evidence of the historical understanding. Really, that's because so few cases like this have come up at all. I took a look at this yesterday, and going back to 2010, the board has found 13 petitioners to be innocent. Only 6 of those petitioners asked for more than $25,000. 2 of them received what they asked for. 4 of them, including my client, did not. There are not very many decisions in which the board expresses its view of what the statute means. There are 2 exceptions to that where the board set forth, I think, the kind of process of reasoning that the Court of Appeals asked for here and that I am asking for here as well. They are Turnpaugh and Schomburg, which, Justice Hagedorn, it is quite possible you had a hand in. In both those cases, the petitioners were not asking for more than $25,000, as in this case. So the board was considering whether to award the maximum amount of compensation or something less. But both of those decisions, and they are in the record at Turnbaugh, beginning at Record 5, page 94, and Schomburg at Record 5, 91, that I would direct the court to as, if nothing else, evidence that the claims board can, without great difficulty, set forth a process of reasoning when determining the amount that is equitable and appropriate to award. Did that answer your question, Justice Hagedorn?
Sure. Yeah, thank you.
Back to the 1935 revisions, and that's where the second sentence of Chapter 990.0017 comes into play. If the revision bill contains a note which says that the meaning of the statute to which the note relates is not changed by the revision, the note is indicative of the legislative intent, and this is not just any legislative history. It's not even any note on a bill that was put before the voting legislators. It is also legislative history that the legislature has directed us to look at. And in this case, there is indeed a note, and it is in our supplemental appendix and quoted in the brief, that confirms beyond the shadow of a doubt that the 1935 legislature had no intention to change the meaning of the 1913 statute relevant to this case.
I heard counsel for the claims board, Mr. Roth, say that it doesn't matter that he wins under 1913 statute as well. Why is that? Well, that may be a new argument that you're referring to, but why is that not the case?
It is not the case for two reasons. One, I disagree that this court can conclude that the board did in fact determine that $25,000 is not only the limit on what it may award, but is the amount that will in fact equitably compensate Sanders, as if it is a mere coincidence that it happens to be the statutory maximum. I disagree that this court can conclude that the board made that finding because it is not stated in the board's decision, because the pages of the board's opening brief and reply brief that I cited to earlier and quoted briefly from contradict the idea that the board thought it even had the power to determine whether more than $25,000 would be the amount that would equitably compensate Sanders. And then lastly, to the extent the argument is that we can infer that the board made that determination, notwithstanding what I think are conflicting statements in the board's briefs to this court, I would direct the court most particularly to Hacker. The Hacker v. State of Wisconsin Department of Health and Social Services case, which we cite in Section 1D of our argument, and especially to page 477 of the Wisconsin Reporter. I think that very argument was rejected there. Sure, we can all speculate that the agency, it must have made a determination that's not evidenced in its decision. That is exactly the kind of argument that the Hacker court on page 477 said should not fly.
And you're saying the argument would be they must have made that determination based on the fact that they went with the $25,000 maximum.
That's right. Even aside from the fact that the board has, in my view, told this court in its briefs that it believed it did not need to determine that the maximum was coincidentally, the right amount to equitably compensate the Sanders, and even though I think it also has told this court that it did not believe it could determine that any amount above $25,000 was needed, setting all that aside, under Hacker, and you won't be surprised to hear, I would also point the court to Reidinger, it is necessary for the board to set forth a process of reasoning so that this court and the Court of Appeals, and in future cases, circuit courts and circuit court judges ordinarily are the ones who must review these decisions. This agency and other agencies, to enable meaningful judicial review, need to set forth the process of reasoning so that judges are not called upon to speculate as to whether a determination was made or to guess as to why the determination was made, if it was made.
Counsel, you've mentioned a few times that the board said it doesn't believe it could award more than that. I mean, I understand sort of the initial award part, but I just want to make sure I'm understanding exactly what you're pointing to when you're making that statement and what it refers to. So, see, the board is saying, might have been its initial determination. I'm sorry.
In the decision or in the briefs? Because when I asked that question, he pointed to the briefs.
Yeah, I guess I just want you to expand on that further. I guess I understood the board saying, in our initial determination of what to award, we think the legislature has given us some limits that we need to decide within. But then, I guess there's still space to say, maybe we do want to give something to the legislature, or ask the legislature not to do something more than that, and that's a different question.
I think, and let me try to answer your question, and also the part of Chief Justice Ziegler's question that I left unanswered before. In the decision of the board, I do not think there is anything that tells us why the board arrived at $25,000 as the number. And that is the problem. The board did not set forth any reasoning to explain that. So from the board's decision, this court, all of us, we are left to speculate as to whether the board believed that it had no power to consider any amount higher than $25,000, or whether it might have considered the question and decided that $25,000 was the right amount for reasons not set forth. We don't know, and for that reason alone, it must be remanded. In the briefs, the board, I think, has clarified that it believed it had no power to consider any amount higher than $25,000. And I cited some pages before, most especially page 40 of the board's opening brief, where I think the board makes that clear.
Where on page 40?
The second paragraph, well, the first full paragraph. In sum, the Court of Appeals majority attempted to transform the claim board into a body it is not, one equipped and required to make a determination about the petitioner's total appropriate compensation. There, and also 37 and 38 of the board's opening brief, and 5 through 6, and I think 8 through 9 of the reply brief, the board is telling this court, we need not, we cannot determine the total amount that is appropriate to compensate the petitioner after making a finding of innocence. My light is yellow. If there are any more questions, I'm happy to answer them. Otherwise, I can also take my seat.
All right. Thank you very much. Rebuttal.
Thank you.
And while you're coming up, counsel, I would like to hear your thoughts on the statutory history point, in particular the 1913 law. Justice Ann Walsh Bradley asked about that initially. The brief seemed to suggest maybe that there was a concession that your duties might have looked different during that intervening period, and maybe the 1935 law was a substantive change. But I'm not sure. It sounded like you were arguing something different today, and I wasn't entirely clear.
Right, Your Honor. So I do think that the revision in the statute worked a material change. I do think in the 1913 version, the way it was structured, there was plainly a duty imposed on the board to find the total compensation that would be, I don't have it in front of me right now, but would appropriately compensate the petitioners. I do think the structure, I mean, if you just read the different statutes, you can see that a limiting clause was added. And it's plain that even when something is done through a revisor's clause, a revisor's bill, if there's a change in the plain text, you have to give that change effect. Now, that being said, I do not think that this case, this particular case, it matters one way or the other, because, again, I do think the record fairly read, and I didn't hear a word about the letter that the claims board wrote denying the rehearing petition, which I clearly state that's at Appendix 133. And that rehearing letter expressly says the board, quote, did not conclude that the amount which it was able to award was not adequate compensation. Now, I know there's a lot of negatives in that, but I think you can remove the double negative. Bear a reading of that statement from the board is we found that this was adequate.
Okay, those are two different arguments, so, and I just want to make sure I separate those. So the main question before us is whether an explanation is needed. So your second point is whether one was given or not. But let's put that aside for just a minute and focus, because I understand you maybe you win if that is an accurate reading of the record separately. But can you just address the legal point of why that does the change not matter here simply because you win on alternative grounds, or does the change not matter here legally because you would have won? Yes, it seems like your argument does hinge on 1935 working a substantive change, or does it not?
I don't think it does, Your Honor, because there is no indication in the record that the board concluded that $25,000 was not the total amount. Essentially, what I think the petitioner is saying is, well, the board misunderstood what it could do, misunderstood that it had no authority to consider amounts above and beyond that, which I think is belied both by the record here and by the fact that in other recent cases, the board has plainly considered and issued reports to the legislature recommending more money. It knows it can do that. It's well aware of its statutory authority in that regard. But here, what the record shows is, again, a request for $5 million above the statutory maximum, questioning from the board about that, an award of $25,000, no report to the legislature, and then in this follow-up letter denying the petition for rehearing, an express statement that we did not find that this was inadequate. I think taking all of those facts together, the only thing one can infer is that it did conclude that $25,000 was the right amount. And so, therefore, under the 1913 statute, that would have passed muster, and likewise, under the current statute, I believe it passes muster. So while I do believe that a material change was effected, as we argue in our brief, I don't think it really matters here because, again, there's no indication that the board, you know, just didn't know what it could do. I frankly find that both in tension with the record and simply implausible.
Counsel suggests that is your concession in your brief.
Well, it's a concession in the sense that it's an acknowledgement that there was a meaningful change in the statute. That is, before the revision, there was a requirement to ignore any statutory cap on what the board could award and pick a number, and that's the compensation. That, you know, 25,000 of that the board will award, and then the rest it'll send to the legislature as a recommendation. I do think that changed, and that's different. There's no total award requirement anymore. It's very clear that there's now a limiting clause placed on the determination of equitable compensation, and the board, you know, delivered a decision within that clause, and from its decision not to recommend more, plus the express acknowledgement in Appendix 133 that we didn't find that this was inadequate. I don't know how else to read that. I mean, that's Again, there's double negatives, which perhaps there's a more clear way to word it, but it says what it says. And I see my time is up. Thank you very much.
All right. I would like to ask you a question, but I'll hold off, too, because your time is up.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for interesting oral argument. We appreciate all the students being here today. The court is adjourned in this matter. We have a meeting over the noon hour, and then right after that meeting, we'll receive the closed conference. All right. Have a nice day, everyone.